24 on News Talk 1130 WISN. BidOnMilwaukee.com is now open for bidding. BidOnMilwaukee.com. Don't forget about that today. Yeah, Wisconsin kids can sell lemonade. The livestock are less nervous. It was a huge day in the state Senate yesterday. J.R. Ross of WisPolitics.com was there watching it. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. We saw some action in the Senate yesterday. They passed about a dozen bills. Some of them were holdovers from the last session. And I see one of them is an update on the state's hemp growing program. How did they update that? Because that's sort of a growing industry here in Wisconsin.
Essentially, the short answer is they're trying to match the state program to the federal 2018 Farm Bill and the changes it made with hemp laws. There's also a tweak. So right now, the psychoactive ingredients in cannabis, there is a trace of it in hemp, not enough to get you high, essentially.
Right.
But there is a zero-tolerance law on the books in Wisconsin if you're driving with any trace of it in your system. That can impact people who are using legal CBD products, right?
Right.
They are changing that, or they want to change that, so that they don't have that zero tolerance anymore, but they want to codify with current practice. So certainly there's a level that law enforcement uses right now. They say, okay, it's not zero tolerance for in practical purposes. It's this level. They want to make that level state law going forward. So again, if you're using CBD, you're not going to get charged for driving the implant.
It would be sort of like alcohol. If you have one drink, okay, it's not it's in your system, but it isn't rising to a level where it's impairing you, right?
Yeah, and there were concerns about the bill from law enforcement originally because it would have taken it out altogether. They're basically reaching a compromise with law enforcement to keep some kind of limit there going forward.
Another bill that would make it clear, you know, we've seen these incidents over the years of children putting up lemonade stands and they're breaking the local code or ordinance and they get shut down. We have a bill that made it clear children can operate lemonade stands on private property without a permit. And I assume it isn't restricted to lemonade, but does it spell out what can and cannot be sold by children on a street corner?
Any food that could be hazardous. So it has to be refrigerated to prevent the growth of microorganisms or, you know, like something with raw eggs that has salmonella. You can't do those kinds of foods.
Okay.
This is trying to make it, you know, kids selling ice cream or bottles of water, lemonade, something like that would be okay, but it does have some restrictions. You can make up to $2,000, which would be a pretty healthy lemonade stand.
Yeah,
I would say. You have to be a minor, so it can't be like a 19-year-old kid out there selling stuff and making enough money to go to college, right?
Uh-huh. So the kids that are selling water in downtown Milwaukee on hot days, they're fine too?
Well, that's going to be interesting to watch, right? Because we kind of had this image of the lemonade stand being what, you know,
right,
a suburban block. Well, what's it going to happen in that scenario? So, I mean, it's
I hope they don't shut them down because they're little entrepreneurs, those kids. It's sort of funny to watch them. So the lawmakers also clarified what an electric bike is and where it can be ridden. And I just mentioned this for informational purposes for the audience. They initially labeled these electric bikes akin to motorbikes, and they were being regulated that way. They're regular bikes with a small electric motor on them, so they can now be ridden anywhere a regular bike can be, right?
Yeah,
trails,
I think so.
And things.
Yep, yeah. I'm pretty sure about that.
Okay, so let's talk about this then package that the Assembly is looking to move through. That it's a package of I think about 10 items, rule changes, but the primary rule changes getting attention are two, with one of them being a change that would allow this paralyzed lawmaker, Jimmy Anderson, to phone into committee meetings as he has requested. So do we have the problem solved here?
Yes, but Robin Voss and some of the leadership is getting a pound of flesh out of Democrats in the process. And why I say that is Jimmy Anderson, paralyzed from the chest down, he and his family were in a car hit by a drunk driver some years ago. He has been asking for an accommodation to be able to participate in committee hearings when sometimes he can't make it to the Capitol. He is in a wheelchair, but there are limits on how many hours he can be in that chair. So it causes him conflict sometimes, in his words, of being able to do his job. So Jimmy began to be more public about this in the summer. They had pushed for it from a document that I got back in the beginning of the session. They're talking about a rules package, but mm-hmm. It really hadn't become public until the summer. Republicans at first were kind of on the defensive, then started accusing Jimmy of being political with this. So out comes this rule package.
Right.
That would allow him to call in, but they paired it with things like, right now in the Assembly, you get one shot at a veto override vote, and if it fails, that's it. Well, now they're going to allow as many as you want. So things like that that are changing that would, for example, establishing, right now they have a process where the two sides get together and establish time limits for debate. It was done to try and make things more orderly after Robin Voss took over post-Act 10. That whole debate went on for, I think, 4 days, whatever it was, to try and have some kind of formal process. And they've been okay for the most part. But this one, it creates possibilities that if no agreements reached on time limits, the Rules Committee, which is controlled by Republicans, can impose them on its own. Things like that that they're doing to make things run easier for them.
Right.
And make things harder for Democrats.
And my question would be then, is this out of a normal routine? I mean, this is an entire package of rule changes. It's not like the assembly leaders intentionally plotted to get something in return for Anderson's issue to be resolved, or is it? Does it look like that?
I don't know. I'm not sure if that was part of it, but normally, I mean, honestly, usually they vote on this the first day of the session or very early in the session. Here we are in October. They haven't done any new rules package yet. So it's kind of odd that's coming up now. But the Democrats very much see this as the Republicans trying to kind of camouflage these changes by tying it to something for Jimmy Anderson, because the attention is on that, all these other things go through without as much public attention.
Yeah, my point would be, though, is that they're voting on rule changes in batches like this. That would be a normal process. The process is normal, even if some of the things they're requesting in terms of rule changes are not.
Yeah, okay. Usually at the beginning of the session, not in October.
I see the Republicans who control the Senate passed a resolution backing the Air Force plan to base some F-35 fighters at Madison's Truax Field. This has been controversy locally with Madison officials trying to block it. They say these are noisier jets. They're making a noise argument. There are others who just don't like the military and I think don't want to see any sort of military activity increase there in the Madison area. Why would the state Senate pass a resolution backing the F-35s at Truax Field? I can't the Air Force just place them anywhere they darn well please?
Yes, they can. Yes, they can. Mostly the voice they've been hearing, though, the Air Force, has been from a vocal group of local residents in Madison and some city council members, a couple state reps who represent the Madison area. This is a resolution getting the state Senate, and it'll go to the Assembly tomorrow, them on the record backing it. Scott Fitzgerald, the majority in the Senate yesterday, said that his worry is it's not just about these jets and the jobs that they would bring, because there's an expectation that if you replace the F-16s that are there with these F-35s, they'll create about 1,600 jobs. Hmm. It's not just about losing out those jobs. It's about possibly losing the mission of Truax Field. If you lose the mission of that base, the next time you look at around the base closings, it goes in the chopping block. And that's kind of Fitzgerald's argument was you don't want empty buildings out there. You have to have a mission for this to keep that base there. So
is
now,
that what the liberals, the Madison liberals, want? I'm sort of from a distance. You're watching this more closely than I am. From a distance with my conservative biases, I'm seeing Madison liberals attempting to close down a military base entirely. No planes, no reason for it to be here. Close it down.
There are some residents near the airport who don't like the F-16s because it is disruptive. I mean, I live about, 3-4 miles from the airport. You can hear them clear as day when they take off. So I'm not right there at the initial burst. But for the most part, it's not like it's the entire city that's been voted in a referendum or anything saying this is a bad thing.
Okay.
It's been this kind of vocal group of residents and people represent them. Now, one thing to note is that Senator Miller, who's a Democrat from Monona, he was in the Air National Guard for 30 years. He is one of the co-sponsors of the resolution, the only Democrat that got on it yesterday in the Senate or in the Assembly either, I think. Other thing to note that it passed via voice vote, so nobody actually went on the record in the Senate opposing this resolution in that way. Fred Risser, longtime Democrat from downtown Madison, he tried to amend the resolution to add a provision encouraging the Air Force Base to do more research. It was rejected also via voice vote. So that's the thing about lawmakers, even the Madison reps. I mean, other than a couple of Madison reps, a lot of folks who represent the area aren't going on the record through a vote like this saying no.
Right.
It's all being done on voice vote. It's a very delicate.
They're claiming just swapping out the F-16s with an F-35 is going to bring 1,600 more jobs there?
Something like that, yeah.
Wow. All right. And then finally, one last question on Senate Leader Fitzgerald. He's running for Congress in Jim Sensenbrenner's seat, of course, and you can see that he's already sort of doing some things and saying some things as a, quote, candidate. He called the move by the Democrats to impeach the president a witch hunt yesterday. If he wins the primary, he'll essentially win the general because this is such a heavily Republican district. So is this just an easy call for him when he's asked that question?
Oh, it's kind of one of the talking points we're seeing out of Washington. And part reason why I think you're seeing that is, you know, the 5th Congressional District does have, like, a little more of a suburban feel than, say, the 7th, right, up in northern Wisconsin. But I asked Charles Franklin, he does the Marquette University Law School poll, to basically aggregate the job approval ratings for President Trump in the 5th just to see how he's been doing. And if you go back over the last 3 years, there's no real downside for any candidate in the 5th to be, like, really super pro-Trump. From what Charles did was he took all the polls out from 17, 18, and 19. He gave you a good, healthy number. He said usually you kind of avoid doing something of that big of a long of a span, but because the president's job approval has been so stagnant, like just basically so locked in at that point, it's more valid scientifically. Shorter answer, 84% of Republicans in the 5th CD approve of Trump's job performance, while 11.6% disapprove. Yeah. So if you're going to win that primary, you got to win those voters who think highly of President Trump. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer in some ways.
It's interesting in an area that voted for Ted Cruz in the primary. Also, we saw, this is significant, we saw Governor Evers restart the pardon process after Scott Walker he philosophically was not going to pardon anyone.
Yep.
He just shut the whole thing down. Evers restarts the process. He pardons 4 people who, you know, are very worthy of a pardon. They made one bad mistake many years ago. They served their prison time, and now they just have this felony mark on their record that won't allow them to, you know, go into the military or advance in the military. I thought that these were very, very reasonable pardons. At the same time, does this process get more controversial, do you think?
What's the question they have? Because there were actually 5 people went for the Pardon Advisory Board the first hearing and had their cases heard. Evers gave 4 pardons but denied the 5th. From what I can tell, the online records of that guy, he had a drug charge on his past, I believe. And I went through, in the first 2 months that after Evers opened up this process, I went through everybody who had applied and matched them against online court records to see, you know, what charges they'd been convicted of. By far, the most frequent charge was a drug offense. Mm. Now, there were, you know, delivery, or manufacturers, delivery, intent to deliver, that stuff like that.
Right.
The question kind of is, where is the scale going to be? Is there like a certain level? I mean, some of these folks, they had very small amounts. Like one guy from the pardons this week, you know, he was convicted of selling cocaine at 19. Now he's 40. Start the pardon to pursue being a military chaplain. The guy who was denied, he was convicted of being a party manufacturer with intent to deliver less than 200 grams of marijuana, about 7 ounces. I found in my search people who had larger amounts, had more complex cases.
Yeah.
What's going to happen with them? And, oh, by the way, Brandon Dassey is now the guy from the Teresa Halbach murder and the Making a Murderer Netflix series. He's applied for a pardon. The rules that Evers put down, the standards, say you have to be serve your sentence and be out of office supervision for 5 years. Well, he's not.
Right.
Evers is going to consider that, but how does he fit into the criteria? And is Evers going to bend it sometimes for if he finds a worthy case? That's going to be something fascinating to watch going forward.
Thank you, sir. We'll talk again next week.
Take care.
J.R. Ross of WisPolitics.com.